This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
We all would like to write books.
No.
Like to write a book. I thought of every single person out there that has spent any time in sports or life in general wants to write a book. My wife wrote a novel. She's halfway through her second novel. I have friends like Kipper and Doug who have both written books. John Shannon wrote a book.
Yeah.
And I take credit for one of those books. I take credit for inspiring Evolve or Die by John Shannon.
Why?
Been given credit for that.
Let me just check the dedication.
Did not get anything.
Let me see this. To my pal Darren for inspiring the book. I think it says it right there. Oh, no.
That's in crayon. You just wrote that. No, I would tell you all the time, we would catch up and you would tell me a story. I'm like, you got to write a book. You got to write a book. Yeah. And then you started saying, I'm thinking about it. I wrote a chapter. I didn't get credit at all. And I've held that in all these years and almost 50 episodes of 100% Hockey. I've held it in and I've got to get it off my chest.
I'm just seeing if you're in the book at all. Oh, yeah, you are. Twice. You're in twice.
No, see, I know. By the way, first place I look for anybody that writes a book that I know. Well, I look at the back to see if I'm mentioned.
So my favorite story about the book and dealing with a publisher. So you first of all, they didn't want the name Evolve or Die. They didn't want that. They thought it was stupid. So I said, that's fine. And we waited 9 months and they said, okay, what's the name of the book? I said, Evolve or Die. Brilliant.
So really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Was it a different person, I hope.
No, same guy.
Wow.
So he had finally read the galleys of the book because they want you to come up with the title before you put anything on paper. So so that was the one thing. The other thing is they said, okay, do you and it's not a big book. It's like almost 300 pages. Do you want an index? And I said, well, yeah, I do want an index. Yeah. That'll be $1,000. I said, what? I said, no, we don't do indexes anymore unless the author wants it and they have to pay $1,000. So I said, well, you know what? I'm one of those guys that if a friend of mine writes a book, I do go check the index. And it's, I'll pay the $1,000 to put the index in. So you have to pay somebody who's a professional index writer to write the index.
Well, that would be hard.
I know.
The index.
I know. I know. I don't know whether they would just, every time they see a name, put a little stroke beside it and say page one, page six. By the way, I think you're on page 246 and 299. So,
because you got to actually read the book if you're doing the index.
Yeah. I guess. Anyway.
If you're not a very good indexer,
yeah,
you're not a very good reader. You get busted pretty fast.
Yeah. Oh, hey, these people, these editors, and guys that work for Simon and Schuster, they are meticulous. They would say on page 17, line 3, I would say, I wrote this 9 months ago. I have no clue what I said on page 1. So I'd have to go back to the galleys and go through the pages and say, yeah. I said, did you really mean that? Oh, yeah, I really meant that. Well, why did you phrase it that way? It says, because I was pissed off. Oh, okay.
You would be difficult to navigate a book with.
I was great to work with.
Because you're a producer,
yeah.
And now you're an author, and you think you know everything.
It, not necessarily in that order.
Yeah, you think you know everything. Now you're a producer. Did you like writing a book? I don't know why we're on this subject, other than I never got credit. But
well, at times I did. I liked it at times. It was cathartic at times, too.
Did you have a ghostwriter?
They offered me one. I didn't. I said, there's no way, because I think if you write a book, I want to be able to hear the voice. And I think I write in a certain manner the way I speak. And the sentence structure is, for me, different than it would be if there was a ghostwriter. And so I just said, no. And it, you know, it happened during the pandemic. So it actually got me out of bed a lot of days to get up and say, okay, I got to do a thousand words today, or I got to do a story today. And that part was easy to do when, quite frankly, you had nothing else to do with social distancing.
How long would it take you to do 1,000 words? I have no idea.
Well, some days it would take you an hour, and some days it would take you 2 days.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So it was 1,000 words a chapter? Like, give me some context on how long,
that's the other thing. I didn't want 50 chapters. So that's a guy that writes books that are 50 chapters, and each chapter is 3 pages long. So it's almost kind of like a bullet form. Yeah. I wanted to have only, you know, 11 or 12 chapters with long form stories in it that made sense. Once we decided that, it was pretty straightforward. One chapter in my book's 20,000 words, and it's the four most important people that affected my career.
And you're not included on that, either.
No, you weren't on that list either. Nope. So no.
So after coming together on 100% Hockey, do you think I could crack a top five
of influential people
in your life? Like, you only put four in there. That tells me that five's available.
No, it's like Mount Rushmore. We're not carving another piece of the rock.
Well, there's a little mountain available there.
We're not carving another piece of the rock.
All right. Well, Ron Francis has just saved you.
Yeah, we were supposed to talk hockey here, and like, what another great night. And
we will on the back end of this.
How can we not talk about the Winnipeg Jets?
I got a bunch of stuff written down.
Okay.
All right. And we'll get into it after we discuss things with the Seattle Kraken and life with the general manager of the 32nd franchise, Ron Francis, coming up. Here's the general manager of the Seattle Kraken. Before we get into everything, what's going on this week in the National Hockey League? There's so many goals, and we're a week and a half out from the playoffs, and things have gotten all loose. Can you explain what we're seeing?
Well, probably a combination of a couple of things, right? The teams that are in are trying to make sure they get there and get there healthy. So maybe not as tight as they need to be when the playoffs start. And then some of the other teams know their season's coming to an end. So it's been a little more run and gun and a little loosey-goosey, sorry, sort of on both ends of the ice.
I was blaming all those college kids people were playing, Ron.
Yeah. As an OHL guy, yeah, we'll blame them.
So, go ahead, Ron, John.
No, I'm just saying. So, you know, your team started the season with a lot of hope. Where, as we get to the last 10 days of the season, where are you, and what do you have to do?
Yeah, no, I thought going into the season, it's the best team we had. It didn't happen for us this year. Some of it was, you know, we had some weird injuries. The Jordan Eberle one, you know, taking your captain out of the lineup for 3 months and, you know, 40 games he missed and then probably another 10 or 15 to get back up to speed is tough. I mean, Vince Dunn, we were top defenseman for 6 weeks. So some key injuries we struggled with, but, you know, a couple areas. And one I can explain is back-to-back games. We're 0 for the season, which is, you know, it's been hard to do. Nobody's done that for a long time. So that's been real frustrating. And then, you know, the other one still is, you know, our special teams need to be better.
Have you dug into the back-to-back games a little more than you would normally just to try and come up with some explanation?
Yeah, no, we've looked at it. We've tried to figure out some things. Obviously, with the Four Nations this year, the schedule's a little tighter, travel's a little tougher. We've had some of those. I can't blame all of them on those. Like, for instance, the other night, Salt Lake City, when we're playing Utah, We played in LA at 7:30, start the night before. By the time we walk into our hotel rooms, it's 3 a.m. The guys can't get to bed for another hour or two. So it's kind of a tough schedule one, but you know, that's not an excuse. We've got to find a way to get points in the second night of back-to-back games. Cause as we all know, moving forward, next year's schedule is not going to be any easier. We've added 10 days off with the addition of the Olympics. So there's going to be more sets of back-to-backs, and we've got to find a way to be better in that.
You know, we had Steve Hatzepetras on the show a week ago, the schedule maker. Maybe you should sit down with a map and geography and time zones and explain it to him.
it is, and every team, I'm sure there isn't a GM in the league you can talk to that doesn't have their horror stories. I mean, certainly we had a tough one right before in the month of December. We flew coast to coast, played Carolina, the Islanders, New Jersey, and the Rangers, 4 games in 5.5 days. After the game on Sunday afternoon in New York, flew home, played Florida, sitting waiting for us. And then a week later, I mean, that was 14 hours of travel in that window, and then 3 time zones out and back. And then a week later, we flew 4 hours and 45 minutes to Chicago to play a game, to fly over top of Colorado to play Vegas, to turn around and fly back to Colorado the next night to play them waiting for us. It was 10 plus hours to play 3 and 4. So the joys of being on the West, I never experienced it as a player in the East, but there's some challenges for sure that we have to be better at adjusting to.
You just had a series with Dallas at home. It was separated by a day off, but it was 2 games against the same team in 3 days in Seattle. Would you like to see more of that? Or would you open to more of that?
Yeah, we've actually had that pretty much the last 3 years. We did that in Nashville. We played 2 games in Nashville.
That's scary.
That can be dangerous. We had one last year actually at home against the then Arizona team. The crazy part of that is they came and played us. We flew out of town to play, I think, Vancouver, and then flew back to play them again. They didn't have to leave Seattle, which was an interesting twist of playing a back-to-back in your hometown. But yeah, it certainly cuts down the travel a little bit, so it does make it a little more interesting.
Do you like it?
I don't mind it at all, yeah. I don't.
So if they told you you would have one series on the road with 2 and 3 games somewhere, like Nashville or Tampa or Carolina, and then one team coming to your city and doing the same thing, that would be a good remedy?
Yeah, we've had that, I said, each of the last season, but just the one set of whether – you know, I think 2 years ago we were in Nashville for 2 games, and then in the last 2 years we've had teams here. So I'm open to that. Yeah, I wouldn't have a problem with that at all.
So you can't sit there and say we can't play back-to-backs because everybody plays back-to-backs. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to mitigate any of that, Ron?
No, I mean, I think some of it depends on the dates you submit to the league. You know, everybody looks at Steve Hatzepetras and points the fingers and gets mad at him. But I mean, you're dealing with 32 different NHL teams. You're dealing with a lot of venues that have multiple tenants in it. You're dealing with limited dates with concerts and stuff too. So, you know, everybody's going to have parts of their schedule that they don't like. That's the way it is. And it's up to us to, you know, not go 0-12 and back-to-back games and find a way to get some points. I mean, that's a difference for us of being able to be in the playoff spot or not.
Vegas was hosting your club last night, and in preparation for the game, I was going through and I looked at my colleague, Jeff Sharples, and said, I love so many parts about this team, from the ads, from the kids that have scored, from your goaltender that's played great. I can't correlate it to your record. Now, I don't watch you every single night, but there's a paradox there.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, last night in some ways sort of been a microcosm of our season. We had, I think, more than one good chance to score a goal, and we weren't able to do it, and that seems to be, you know, part of our problem is not being able to create the offense. And once we do create the offense to get the opportunity to bury it, we struggle to do that at times. And I think if you have a power play that's clicking and you know, in the top part of the league, then that sort of alleviates some of that pressure on the 5-on-5 scoring. And you know, a couple of years ago when things were going well, that's what we were doing well. We were playing quick up and down the ice. We were creating opportunities. We were scoring goals. And we just haven't been able to get the production to where we need it. And that's something we need to look to try and adjust this summer.
Speaking of Vegas, do you think there's still a comparison to Vegas that is, you know, in the back of people's minds when it comes to expansion teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably normal for people to sort of compare that. You know, from day one, we said we knew it was going to be different. It just was. I mean, they were the first team to go through it. You know, teams had the experience of going through it when we came along. There was multiple years in between that window. As I said, Vegas did nothing wrong, but they had nobody sitting on the side that could affect their expansion draft. We had Vegas sitting on the side, and ultimately they did make a couple of trades, which affected our expansion drafts, you know, a selection process kind of like within 24 hours. So there's a lot of things that were different. We just weren't going to get the same deals that they got. And, you know, instead of somebody saying, hey, take this guy and we'll give you something, they're saying, if you want this guy, you give me something with seven picks. It's pretty hard to do it that way. So we had to do it a different way. You know, our philosophy is to draft and develop, and it's a longer path to get there. But we certainly feel comfortable with a lot of the pieces we have in the pipeline, and you know, we're getting closer and closer.
So part of that original group, Oliver Bjorkstrand and Yanni Gourde, how difficult was it to trade them at the deadline after, you know, you guys had become a band of brothers out there?
Yeah, no, I mean... Yanni is the kind of guy, you go back and watch our first playoff game against Colorado, and the first 10 minutes, he is the kind of player that made it aware to all of his teammates that we were in the playoffs and we were here to win, and he was dragging him in. And just a terrific person and a good hockey player. Sometimes you got to make these tough decisions. We're looking at a young centerman, Matty Beniers, who just turned 22. A young centerman in Shane Wright, who just turned 21. And then, you know, we signed Chandler Stephenson to the free agent contract last year. And when you look at that and where Yanni's contract was, it just was a tough fit for us moving forward to make it all work. So it's a deal that we look to make. You know, Oliver came to us in an offseason where a team was sort of scrapped against the cap, and we gave up a third and fourth to get him. And, you know, played real well for us. And at the end of the day, in theory, we got a first and second for him at the deadline. So, it gives us draft equity, right? We have now five first round picks, five second round picks in the next three drafts. I'm not sitting here saying we're going to draft 10 players. We'd like to, you know, try and move some of those picks to add to our roster if we can, either before the draft, post draft, as we move forward for sure.
So do you have to change your strategy systematically, tactically, to try and score more goals, or do you just run it back and hope the guys have better years next year?
No, I think there's things in the way we're playing we have to change. you know, I think when we were at our best, we were playing a north-south fast game. We've kind of gotten away from that. We're a little bit more east-west, and I think that takes away from the speed of the north-south game. So, you know, that's one area we'll certainly look to address moving forward. As I said, special teams has been an area of concern for us. We need to make that better on both ends of the rink. You know, the one thing we haven't done as well this year is defend in our zone. We spend a little more time in our zone than I'd like to spend in our zone. So there's areas that we need to figure out, whether that's, you know, changing the personnel we have in our lineup or, you know, adding some different pieces from the outside. You know, we're going to look at all options here in the summer to try and get that right.
The two big acquisitions you did made, Stephenson and Montour, certainly were a step in the right direction, weren't they?
Yeah, they've both been real good production-wise for us. And you know, Chandler gets all the hard matchups for us with you know, two young centermen that I mentioned, and Matty and Shane. It alleviates some of that pressure off of them. And then, you know, Monty on the back end is having a career year, most goals he scored in his career. So those have been nice pieces. Some of the young kids, as you mentioned, Darren, have kind of stepped in and played well. And, you know, we've got some pieces on the fringe that may be able to step in next year and contribute as well.
I knew that Stephenson was smart. And then I watched that overtime goal that he took the draw and pushed it forward. And next thing you know, what is it, was 6 seconds, was it?
Four, I think, yeah.
Not that you were counting, right?
I thought it was five. I think it ended up being four. But, yeah.
I mean, those are smart hockey players that do that type of thing, and every team needs a few more like that, correct?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, I'm watching it from the press box, John, and I'm looking going, oh, no, they're going to go forward against us because they had speed matchup on the opposite side, and instead Chandler went forward to Monty, and he went in and scored on it. So, you know, I was thinking the defensive aspect of it. We were in trouble, and it turned out to be an offensive juggernaut for us that night.
Well, I always remind Darren that, you know, it was hockey's a game of mistakes. So all you guys that overthink the game, you always think defense first, right?
Where are you on your... That's the way I did it, yeah.
On the subject of defense, you've gone through a transition in goaltending and really leaning on Joey this year. Have you stumbled on something? Not necessarily stumbled, but found your guy?
Yeah, we think we have. You know, we took him in the expansion draft. He spent some years down in Coachella Valley, had real good seasons, back-to-back unfortunate losses, but got to the Calder Cup final, so got some experience there and then stepped up and played well for us. We were able to reach a deal with him at the start of this season, so we have him in place now for, you know, the next 5 years after this moving forward. So we think that's helped us. We also do have some real good young pieces in the pipeline for goaltending. You know, Nicholas Koko played in the top league in Finland last year, went all the way to the finals, and this year is having a great year in the American Hockey League. You know, Victor Osman got thrown into the battle the other night, first time ever, and stopped, you know, all 12 shots he faced in the Utah game. So there's some promising pieces to what we have in the pipeline for goaltending as well, in addition to what Joey's done for us up top.
So on the other side of the ledger there, how do you manage what Philip Grubauer's gone through, and where do you expect him to be?
Yeah, it's been a tough year for Philip. You know, early in the year, it didn't go as well. We end up putting him down in the Coachella Valley just to sort of work on his game. Since he's come back, he's been better. He was actually supposed to get the start the other night, but we had the flu bug running through our team. So he was one of the victims, unfortunately, and couldn't go. But, you know, we still think there's a good goaltender there, and we got to continue to find a way to get the best out of him.
Well, I'll tell you what, that I've never seen the flu, and I, COVID aside, because COVID was a different animal, I've never seen the flu so rampant in the league and longer lasting in the league than this year. Have you?
No, and as late in the season, usually it's the January, February months. We're into April, and we had guys throwing up. When we left people in LA, we left people in Salt Lake City. We, you know, trying to manage your roster as you go around the 4-game trip. But yeah, it's been, you know, it's kind of weird. Sometimes you get hit hard with it. This year seems to be that year, and I don't remember it being as late either.
But every night you go through the roster, and then, you know, they say this guy's not going to play, and then you go, well, is he hurt? No, he's got the flu. And there, I'll tell you right now, I think of last night, I think there were 8 teams that had guys out with the flu. 8 teams. It's amazing.
Yeah, I know, and it happened quick. Like, we played the game in San Jose, and in the third period, one guy started not feeling well, and then by the next day, 2 of them were sick and throwing up. And then even the LA game, Phillips threw up right before warm-ups, but by the end of the first period, was not able to activate the e-bug. We just, you know, we wouldn't be able to come into the game if need be. So there's a lot of juggling pieces that are happening kind of behind the scenes, but we haven't had anything for 48 hours, so touch wood, hopefully we've got it behind us here.
And then it affects practice, it affects preparation around the rink. You got to keep everybody separated on the plane and buses. It's a challenge.
Well, we left 2 people behind in LA when we flew to Salt Lake City. We left 2 people behind when we left Utah flying to Vegas. We had them all in for yesterday, but it's, you're trying to juggle all that stuff. We called up Victor Osman for the minors to back up in the Utah game, because, you know, we didn't think Philip could go. So there's a lot of moving parts when that happens. It makes it a little more complicated for sure. But as we've all come to know, it's kind of part of the business here, right?
On the subject of next year, when did you start evaluating what you were going to do or what you needed to do?
I think early in the season, you're always evaluating your team on what you can add or what you can change to make it better. Certainly there comes a point where you say, okay, this isn't going the way we thought it was going to be. Now we got to start making decisions that affect next year. And you know, some of that we did at the deadline. We talked already about Yanni Gord and Oliver Bjorkstrand. We also moved out Brandon Tanev. So, you know, you create some openings, opportunities. We give Yanni Newman a look. We're giving Ryan Winterton a look now. Cal Fleury's been up for some games. John Hayden's been up for some games. Nicholas Cocco, got thrown in a tough one. But, we're trying to look at some of those pieces as to what we have and what we think can fill some of those holes next year internally, or do we have to go outside? There's always the wild cards. Take, for instance, Berkeley Catton. He was the player of the year this year in the Western Hockey League. Is he going to be able to step in next year and play for us or not? That answer probably won't come until we get to training camp and most likely till we look at 9 games for him next season in our lineup. So there's a lot of pieces that you try and put it all together, and you're looking at free agencies, you're looking at who might be up against the cap or needing to make some moves in the offseason. So those have started months and months ago.
Do you and have
Shane
a personal
Wright's turned the corner?
Yeah, I still think there's more work to do there, but he has certainly played much better this season. We talk about him just turning 21. The other thing is the last 2 summers, he only really had 5 weeks to train because he was in Coachella Valley.
Right.
They went to the end of June in the Calder Cup Finals. So I thought this year when he came into camp, he was looked like a different player. And I fully expect that next season, having been able to get the full summer of training under his belt this year, we'll even see more steps forward to him. But he certainly has, the NHL speed and the NHL shot. And there's a few aspects of the game we want to continue to work with and tweak. But overall, we're pleased with his progress for sure.
Can you share any of those aspects, what he needs to dial in on?
I think some of it just comes down to confidence, and confidence with the puck. Getting yourself the routes you run to get yourself in position to get the puck, and once you have it, to be able to carry it with his speed and his hands, he should be able to create a lot of opportunities with that. So some of it is understanding the game a little bit more as, is the D going to go D to D and then on the option, or is he going quick up and I got to be the support? So a lot of just sort of things that happen within a game to continue to work with. But he's already made, we think huge strides from where he was last year and the year before, for sure.
Do you have a philosophy on first-year pros? You talked about Catton and you took your time with Wright.
Yeah, the danger is when they're 18. I think if you go back and look at a lot of these kids when they're 18 and they step into the league, usually at some point they get hurt. And it's just, the league is a grind. It's 82 games. It's the travel. It's big, heavier physical guys. And unless an 18-year-old is, physically ready, it's tough really for that. I find to make that step in and sort of make that adjustment happen easily.
Even though you did it?
It was a different game back then, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. And I was a little bit bigger, I think, than most in my era too. So that helped a little bit, but it's a different game now with some of the skins and the speed of it and everything that's happening. So, Cat will be 19, and that's why I think it's interesting for us. We'll look at him here at Dev Camp again. We'll look at him as the camp opens up in September and get him some exhibition games and get a read. And then you have the 9-game window to play with as we move forward. And I expect us to take full advantage of that as well.
We'll pace ourselves. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more on 100% Hockey with Millard and Shannon, joined by Ron Francis. It's been an emotional week for you, Ron. John Shannon certainly expressed his thoughts on the passing of good friend Greg Millen.
Yeah, Millsy was, I first came to kind of get to know who he was. I was a teenager in Seaside Marine. He came back as a goaltender for the Greyhounds and catching with the right hand was kind of a little different. So kind of caught my eye. And little did I know that a few years later I get drafted by Hartford, we'd be teammates in training camp. And we kind of just hit it off because of our Sioux connection. And then I came back. They sent me back after training camp, called me back up. And it was kind of a 1-game tryout and a 3-game tryout. And Greg and his wife, Ann, were nice enough to say, hey, why don't you just come live with us until you know what's going on, kind of thing. And here's a 23-year-old couple inviting me into their house, and probably the last thing they needed. And it was amazing. Other than the golden retriever Kyle peeing on my leg, I thought it went really well that first year. And we just built a great friendship. And it was interesting the other day, all the Whaler guys, we still all sort of stay in touch and had a group thread going and started sharing some of the stories. you know, around Greg and stuff, and just a terrific person, terrific family man, you know, loved his wife and kids and the spouses and the grandkids, and just had a great zest for life. And, you know, we had a friendship that lasted over 45 years, and he'll dearly be missed.
So in the broadcast business, he was famous for his practical joke of doing a pinprick at the bottom of a coffee cup outside the broadcast booth, and then trying to find somebody he wanted to play a trick on and making sure they picked up that cup. And next thing you know, the coffee's dripping out of the bottom of the cup all over the guy's pants. And Greg thought this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Greg thought this was hilarious. But I can only imagine in the room, it was a little more obvious as what kind of practical jokes Greg would play on you.
Yeah, no, you know, back then we used to fly commercial, and you know, so you're on the commercial flights, and a lot of times you play a game, and you know, by the time you get to sleep, it's one or two, and then you're up at like 4 or 5 to catch a 6 a.m. flight the next day. And so a lot of times guys would fall asleep on those planes. Greg liked to have a little can of shaving cream around and kind of just put it in the guy's head. So when you wake up, the first thing you tend to do is, you know, put your hand in your head and smear the shaving cream in, or stuff like that. The ones we were talking about, there was, you know, Montreal Forum and Lake Coliseum were always famous for the, and still are, for the hot dogs, the Chien Show. And, you know, Greg some nights wasn't playing, and I'd come off the bench in the, you know, off a shift in the third period, and I'd kind of get an elbow, and I'd look over, and he'd be kind of jiggling, laughing a little bit, and he'd show me his catching glove, and his catching glove was the Chien Show. He was eating it during the game, you know, during the third period. And I thought it was maybe just me, but on the thread the other day, it seemed like he was doing it to all of us. So, you know, stuff like that. Or, yeah, we played one time in Maple Leaf Gardens, and we were on the power play, and the ice, the puck, and Joe Quenneville's coming back to get it, and he's doing play-by-play, and he's saying, you know, here comes Quenneville, he's on the power play, I'm not sure what he's doing on the power play. And by the way, all of us on the thread, the Whaler thread, all agreed, we couldn't believe he was on the power play, but Joe comes behind the net, and he goes, he passes it up, and he put it right on the tape of Patty Boutette. Patty took a step in, rifling right over Millsy's shoulder into the net. And now Joel's feeling a little sheepish, and he comes back to Pat Millsy on the pads, and Millsy's just laughing so hard. Like Joel said, his stomach must have hurt for a month. He was laughing so hard that Joel turned that over. So he certainly loved to have fun. You know, it was never vicious fun. It was kind of, you know, kind of humorous stuff, but just a great personality that way, right? And a terrific friend, and as I said, husband and family man was outstanding.
So it's funny you bring the one I reminded of that he talked about a lot. He never minded, the goalies hate being scored on.
Yeah,
but he never minded helping somebody. The famous story, and he's told you this story, I'm sure, is he sees Randy Carlyle before the game, and they were teammates in Pittsburgh. And Randy's now playing for John Ferguson in Winnipeg. And they see each other, and Randy says, yeah, it's been a great year, but, you know, I'm one goal short of a big bonus. And Greg says, what do you mean? He says, no, if I get another goal, if I get 20 goals, I get a lot of money. So here comes Randy somewhere in the game. Here comes Randy down the wing, and he rifles it, and Greg just whiffs it. He whiffs it, and it's in the net, and Randy gets the bonus. Next thing you know, John Ferguson Sr. has come down from the press box and is in the Zamboni entrance banging on the glass saying to Greg, you did that on purpose. You did that on purpose. And Greg would have that, you know, that impish smile and the glint in his eye and say, well, you know, hey, you never know. Hey, you never know. Yeah. So yeah, that was Greg. Yeah.
I thought we were good friends, but he never let me get one on him like that. So,
well, he was a little, I'm sure he got a little jealous when, you got to go to the Stanley Cup champions. You know, I mean, I think that that would have been a hard move for him, that he was somewhere else and you were in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we were teammates for a while, and then he actually got traded in a deal from Mike Liut, which came out of Hartford. The other thing, just talking, that I remember, you know, back then you have to spend a lot of times in the airports, And he loved the dollar bill trick, right? Where you take a piece of thread and you put a needle through the dollar bill and you kind of throw it out in the middle of the hallway and somebody's walking down and sooner or later somebody looks down, sees the dollar bill, and they reach down to grab the dollar bill and he just pull it, right? And then some people would kind of look around, other people would chase it for like four or five times and he'd just be over there laughing, pulling the dollar bill, and love having fun just to make the guys laugh, right?
Yeah. He's something. I will say this. I don't want this to be the end of the show because I've got some GM questions, but I just want you to know that he loved you, man. He really did.
It was likewise. We had a great friendship.
Yeah. You were at the GM's meetings?
I was, yeah.
How would you, where do you think the managers think the state of the game is?
Yeah, I mean, the NHL does a report, and it's, you know, it's certainly positive in a lot of ways with goal scoring up and comebacks and the parity and stuff. from a personal standpoint, probably have some concerns on some of the things. Face-offs for me is one, and line change is another for me. Those weren't really big topics at the GM meetings this year, but, you know, I'd like to see those called a little bit more like the rules that are in the books. Quite frankly, like a line change is 5 feet. Most nights now we're seeing 40, 50, 60 foot line changes under the premise it doesn't affect the player, it doesn't touch the puck. And to me, that's wrong, but doesn't seem to be a big uproar about that. So I might be in the minority on that one. So anyways.
And face-offs, is that the getting kicked out of the draw?
Couple things. I think the encroachment, pretty much every face-off now, at least one player standing with a skate inside the circle, which you're not supposed to do. We had discussion on this last year. As a centerman, I think you're asking the first player, the defensive player, to go down and put a stick on the ice. If the second player, the offensive player, doesn't come in and touch the white, at least, and he's able to come across the faceoff circle and sweep back in one motion, to me, that is a huge advantage for that faceoff centerman. And as a defensive guy, it's pretty tough to win that draw if that's happening. So I think in making it fair, that would be something we look at. And we do have a faceoff violation rule on the book, but it's, you know, it hasn't been enforced, I think, in a season and a half. So,
well, yeah, it had. I asked earlier in the year, had they changed the rule? I mean, weren't there supposed to be penalties if you're kicked out twice? Wasn't it supposed to be?
That is the rule. I think the last time that was called was maybe early last season, I guess, against the Islanders. I think that was the only time I think it's been called in the last 2 years. So,
And are you satisfied with the explanation you got for goaltender interference? It seems to have died down a little bit since the meetings, but at the same time, maybe there aren't as many big traffic jams in front of goalies between then and now.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. We looked at 54 clips. The one that affected us that I was really frustrated with was not in the 54 clips. listen, it's a hard thing, but for me, to narrow it down to black and white, for me, it's if the player goes into the blue paint, he does so at his own risk. And if there's any kind of contact, shame on the player, no goal. If the player is standing outside the blue paint, but yet he's got his arm in there or his stick in there or his ass in there and he's making contact, again, shame on the player. Conversely, if the goaltender is outside the blue paint and there's any kind of instruction, then it's shame on the goaltender for me. And the same thing, if the goaltender is standing in the paint, but yet he's got his glove outside the paint on the guy's back or something, then again, that's on the goaltender. I know it's not quite that simple, but I think if you use that for your baseline, and ironically, you know, when we voted on the 54 clips, I was in the high, probably 90% of agreement with what they had ruled. So, it's not an easy thing to rule on. I would have liked to seen the one that we had called against us not in there, but at the end of the day, I think I think that's what they're trying to do and to make it as black and white as possible. I think those are some of the guidelines you have to use.
Do you understand it more now than you did 5 years ago, though, or are you?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I spent a lot of time with Mike Murphy on the phone when he was running the show. And that was sort of in dialogue with him. I think we both came to that sort of conclusion, right? If you're, and I know people say, well, he didn't really do anything or I was just, he was making a move. To me, he's in the blue paint. If we don't like that, then reduce the size of the blue paint if that's what we want. But to me, I think right now, if the player's in the blue paint, contact happens, it's on him. And if it's outside, the goaltender's outside, it's on the goaltender. That's I use that for the basis and tell our guys that's sort of what we need to look at when we're going to decide on making any challenges or not.
On line changes, Ron, I'm just curious. Do you tell your guys to follow the limits within the rules? And if so, that puts you at a disadvantage then.
As far as?
Like the line changes, being within 5 feet, being within 10 feet. Or do you just say, okay, it's the Wild West, you do whatever you want?
Well, it's been an interesting thing. We've had three penalties called against us for two men on the ice. One in Pittsburgh where McCann came over the boards, skated maybe 12 feet from the bench, realized he's to me, turned around, went back to the bench. Didn't touch the puck, didn't affect the play, but that was a penalty. We had one in Seattle where I think it was Kako stepped off the bench, took 2 feet and went back, and that was a penalty. Yet I've seen one. We had one a couple weeks ago where we were killing a penalty. We iced the puck. As soon as we iced the puck, the guy jumped over the boards. And on the overhead, you can't even see him. You're watching the five guys change on the bench. And then all of a sudden he comes, he's at the far faceoff dot coming up the ice with the puck. That's how early he changed, right? It's a 50, 60 foot line change. Yeah. And that is not a penalty. And that's when I watch it, I get frustrated with that. I think the other thing, I mean, John, you remember the old days. You used to hustle to the bench.
Oh, yeah.
For a line change because you had 5 feet. Now watch it when teams are changing. There's no hustle to the bench. I mean, maybe I'm a dynasty. That drives me crazy, right? Like, get to the bench. Get off the bench. Clear. And when I look at it, it happens a lot, especially second period, killing penalties. Teams will ice the puck, and the two forwards jump over the boards, and they're standing in the passing lanes, right? So, yeah, they're not touching the puck, but they are affecting the play, in my opinion. That happened. I was on the bench in, I want to say, like 2011. We're playing in Montreal. Second period, so you got the long change. We're on the power play. We lose the draw. They ice the puck. The guy jumps over the board. He's forechecking Cam Ward. And I'm screaming, it's too many men on the ice. And the stoppage of the play, the linesman come over and said, it's not too many men on the ice because he didn't touch the puck. I said, so let me understand the rule then. I can put nine guys on the ice, and as long as three of them don't touch the puck, I don't have too many men on the ice. And he said, now you're being a smartass. I said, I'm trying to understand the rule the way you're explaining it to me. And he goes, this conversation's done. I said, yeah, I think it's probably done at this point, right?
But well, the reality is, I guess, if you don't have to touch the puck to be in the play, do you?
Exactly. That's my point. Right. If you're standing in a passing lane, it stops the goaltender for quick upping it, maybe on a breakaway and stuff. It forces guys to hustle to the bench quicker to get the guys off the bench. But it doesn't seem – I seem to be on an island on this one. But it's interesting. Just watch it in the next few games and see if you see any of the things I'm talking about.
Tell you what, game 82 – tell Danny to put nine guys out.
Boy, it's been working. We'll get called for too many men on the ice.
I'm with you on the guys changing, going to the bench, and it's all over the league. And I call it the ski lift. They're going in line for the ski lift. They're just coasting back.
Nobody wants to jump over the boards anymore. They're waiting to go open the door. Yeah. Well, hey, finally, you still having fun? Still like this game? I mean, we've gone something pretty personal this week, but hockey's been your life.
Yeah, I know it has. I love it. I feel fortunate. You know, I started skating when I was 2.5, playing when I was 3. I turned pro at 18. You know, I'm still in the game at 62. I'm loving it. You know, the beauty is, I think in a lot of ways, it keeps you young. One of the benefits was, you know, we get to travel around, we get to see friends. I mean, my wife and I had dinner with Greg like 3 months ago, right? Which was great, spending time. And you grab a coffee on the road with a former teammate or some friend and stuff. And it's easy to stay in touch with all your buddies. So I'm absolutely loving it. You know, I couldn't be more thankful to the game of hockey for the life it's given me. And you know, my family's involved in it now. Two of my boys work for me here in Seattle, which is great. And my wife's still putting up with me and, and likes me, I think. So we're good.
I tell you what, I think I want in on that Hartford Whalers group chat. That's the one I want in on. That sounds like fun.
It was actually the last one was during COVID when Skip Cunningham, our equipment guy, was retiring in Raleigh. We all got together and had a little collection for Skip, sent him his family to Disney World, and all the guys were on it, and just the laughs of everybody getting together. And we do have the text thread. We keep going every now and then, so it's a lot of fun. Special group of guys for sure.
There's always one person in every group thread that kind of keeps it going, that revives it with a chirp every now and then. Who's that guy in the Whalers chat?
Probably Kevin Dineen. Yeah, he's the guy that wow, tends to light it up. But you know, there's so many
figured it was Ferraro. I figured it was Ferraro, but that's
yeah. Who's in the chat? Like that we would know.
Yeah, a lot. I mean, obviously, you mentioned Ferraro, Dean Evason's in it, Dave Tippett, Mike Liu, Telf Samuels, and Kevin Dineen. Millsy was in it. who am I missing here? Mike Liu, Greg Mellon, Phil Quinville, Al Samuelson.
Pretty good team.
Yeah, bunch of guys. I'm sure I'm missing somebody. Paul McDermott was on one, the owner of the Owen Sound team. And
yeah.
Paul Lawless was on one. So there's a lot of coaches still around.
A lot of coaches in there, too.
A lot of coaches and agents and broadcasters. And can't get rid of the whale. We're hanging around everywhere. All
right. That's good. Thanks for this, Ronnie.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
When I first met Ron Francis, he intimidated the heck out of me. I was a younger reporter, and he was well on his way to a Hall of Fame career. He just had that aura about him, that presence. He intimidated me. And I don't think it was anything he was trying to do, but he just, it was there.
So a true confession, Ron was booked for the show for today, 2 weeks ago, before any of the events of last weekend with Greg Mellon. And it just, you know, it's just circumstance that we had a chance to talk to Ronnie this day about Greg and about what was going on in his life and his world, you know, and what was going on with the Kraken. So that's one thing. Ron Francis to me is one of the most cerebral hockey people I've ever met. I put him on that same level as Bob Gainey. And I think in many ways, the way you're talking about Francis was a lot of people were intimidated by Bob as well that way. They're thinkers, great thinkers about the game, how to improve the game all the time. Do I have time to tell one quick story before we talk about
it? Absolutely.
Okay.
After what I did off the top of this episode, you can do whatever you want. Yeah,
I know. I was going to say, by the way, it's available on Amazon still. So I'm producing Hockey Night in Canada in 1980, I want to say 81, in Vancouver. It's the Hartford Whalers against the Vancouver Canucks. Our color man is Bobby Hull. My boss, Ralph Mellenby, loved Bobby Hull, and, you know, Bobby was glib and he was supposed to be great, and Bobby never wanted to work at it. He really didn't care. So in those days, it was a 5 o'clock game on a Saturday in Vancouver. I'm producing and we have a production meeting in the morning that Bobby doesn't show up for. But I sit down with him at some point and say, okay, we're going to talk off the top. We're going to talk about the two young guns. And this is a team Bobby actually played for the year before to be part of his NHL career in Hartford. So we're going to talk about the two young guys on this team. We're going to talk about Pierre LaRouche, 50 goal scorer. You know, he's a bright young light, and we're going to talk about Ron Francis. He kind of reminds me of Jean Beliveau, you know, the upright stance, and he's got dignity, and even at 18 years old, he can be amazing. So we're going to do the opening live at 4:30, Bobby, live at 4:30 on the concourse, overlooking the ice at the Coliseum. Okay, Steve Armitage, the great Steve Armitage, is our host. We get to 4:30, Steve's there. I have decided to go up just to supervise out of the truck. No Bobby. 4:35, no Bobby.
So what did you do when it was live, like for the live hit?
Well, Bobby showed up. It was live to tape. We were going to do it live to tape with the team warming up in the background, the whole thing. So live to tape. So Bobby shows up at 5:05. So now we have to do it live at 5:02. And so I said, okay, Bobby, we're going to do the opening. Get ready. So he says, what am I talking about? I said, what? What am I talking about? I said, we went through this. You're talking about Pierre LaRouche, good young, bright, light, fast, 50-goal scorer, going to be one of those things. And he's going to be a star in Hartford. They really, really believe that he can make a difference for the Whalers as they inch their way back to the playoffs. And you're going to talk about Roddy Francis, how he reminds you of Jean Beliveau, and this and that. And Bobby says, hello, it says it. And he says exactly what I told him, verbatim. Verbatim,
so it's perfect. On the air.
So yes, but when the game started, the Canucks went down the ice, and Ivan Boldarev took the puck down the wing into the slot to Ivan Hlinka, and the puck went in the net. And Hull's commentary was, "Oh, what a great goal! 9 sent it to 21, and 21 put it in." And I turned to the director and I said, this is going to be a long night. So I spent the rest of the night telling Bobby Hull what to say every whistle. And that's how I really, I've told Ronnie that story many times. And that's how I remember Ron Francis.
through the eyes of Bobby Hull.
Bobby Hull, that's right.
Ronnie sounds a little frustrated with the way things have gone this year.
I would be too, wouldn't you?
Well, just talking about the strategy or tactical approach admits they've got to change their style of play. You don't hear that a lot from managers.
No, but I do wonder what the fallout will be at the end of the season with what happens in the front office and with the coaching staff. And if it's been viewed as a success with Dan Bylsma and his staff. So we'll just have to wait and see what's going to happen over the next 30 days in Seattle.
They have scored a few more goals than they did last year.
Yeah. And listen, the Joey Decord signing has worked out to be pretty good, but they're still stuck with Philip Grubauer at this point. So.
A lot of goals. It goes against what Seattle had two pucks in the crease last night, just sitting there, that they weren't able to coax another 9 inches across the line. So that did sum up their night. So they're held to a goal, and then everybody else is just filling the net.
Yeah,
it's surreal right now. A team scored 9 goals last night.
Yes, and obviously ended a team that has...
After allowing 8. The night before.
And the team, who, let's face it, is a walking soap opera, I think, in New York.
New York Rangers.
Yeah, with the Rangers. And let's face it, the Islanders were on fumes. Ilya Sorokin didn't play. He has been, they had no choice but to play him as much as they have. And I'm sure he was exhausted. Even if he wasn't injured. So that's a tough one. Hey, can we talk about the Winnipeg Jets? Seriously.
The Winnipeg Jets. Beat Dallas 4-0?
They beat Dallas convincingly 4-0. This was not a, well, it was a 1-0 game and a couple of empty net goals. It wasn't that way at all, Darren. The Winnipeg Jets really did a masterful job of controlling play. And you know who's made a huge difference for them? A huge difference? Luke Shen. He has changed the personality of the back end, and they are going to be a force in the playoffs. They really are. They are going to be, everybody's talked about since the trade deadline that, Colorado's this and Dallas is that. Winnipeg has more points, has always had more points than them this year. Winnipeg made some subtle changes with Shen and Tanev. I'm not sure anybody can touch the Winnipeg Jets right now.
Luke Shen can fill you in and hurt you.
he's a truck. He's changed a lot of things there. I'm sure in the room, but the level of confidence, I think he's going to make Logan Stanley better. He's impressive. It really is.
Hey, we're going to get the Battle of Florida again.
Yeah, I know. What do you think of that?
People
have said, well, Colorado, Dallas is going to be something special. Tampa versus Florida is going to be just as crazy.
You still might get the Battle of Ontario. Still might. It's out there. I think there's some great matchups. L.A. and Edmonton for a fourth straight year. I think it's going to be cool.
Let's save this stuff for next week. We got other shows to do next week.
Okay. I'm just really excited.
People are tired of listening to your ideas about writing a book. So
I'm going to write a book one day.
But I'll tell you what.
Two ghostwriters.
Well, no, Jen could do it for you.
No. Then we'll get to the truth. She's a novelist. She's already written a book, and she's on her second one.
You know what? Maybe truth is better than fiction.
No. That book's closed. Let's just put it that way. John Shannon, right. That was great. And I really did enjoy you and Ron discussing your memories of our good friend, Greg Millen.
Yeah, it's a good man. Yeah. So, we got a special extra show coming today.
We're going to talk again?
Yep. Michael Andlauer, owner of the Ottawa Senators.
Oh, good.
Coming up.
Yeah, he's got to be excited. I'm
later today.
See how he must be just bouncing off the balls with what's happening. I got a couple of inside baseball questions for him too. If you'll allow me to go
baseball.
Down that path. I didn't know we were getting Andlauer, so I want to just. I've always had this thought that if I ever got a chance to sit down with him, I got a couple of just outside the box. Inside baseball, if that makes any sense. I'll explain it to you on the special episode, the bonus episode. We got to go, though. I'm sorry, John. I got to go. Talk to you next time.
Are you done now?
Yes.